Noon and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for Wednesday, April 24th. And I just want to let folks know we're going to hear bills in a little different order than, oh no, I guess it is order that's listed, right? We're actually going to start with House Bill 2697A because we have a couple members of the House of Representatives that would like to, that are finding refuge over here in the Senate and would like to come and testify. So with that, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2697A. And Beth, if you can let us know what this bill does.
Yes, Madam Chair, House Bill 2697A allows a person to return a fish carcass to water from which the person caught the fish, provided that the person retain proof of compliance with fishing regulations, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kenner.
Mr. Olson with me, please.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'm already here.
I said Mr., not Senator. Representative Hoyle, come on up. There you go.
Oh, yeah, it's good. Thank you.
We were saying that you were probably worn out after.
Just raring to go. Just another day in the Capitol.
All right, another day, another dollar.
And I thought, but I have to look forward to, I get
fish
to look
carcasses.
Forward to talking about fish guts.
And that just made the whole day right. No, you're going first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kenner, State Representative, District 39. Thank you for having this hearing on House Bill 2697. Appreciate it. This is, we always have to have a few little comments. This is kind of a heady bill or a gutsy thing to do. So, it's in poor taste, but some days we have to do this. It reminds me of my days when I used to be in your chairs. So, a couple of things about it. I guess one is I want to tell a little story. When I was a kid, my best friend was Paul, and he lived with his grandma, and because his mother was an alcoholic, and Mrs. Lane would always take Paul and me camping each summer, and that was my time to learn about fishing. And we had a great trip, and as I'd catch an occasional trout here and there as a youngster, take them in, and Mrs. Lane, not trusting us boys with the knives, would clean the fish. And then it was my job to return their guts to the river. And I remember, I don't know, I was 7 or 8, and I caught a couple of trout right off, and I was real happy. I bounced into camp. Mrs. Lane cleaned them up, and she put them in a little bag, and she said, go throw these in the garbage can. And I go, what? And she says, well, the law's changed. It's now illegal to throw them in the river. And we had a little misunderstanding in those days about what was polluting the river and what was helping the river. So this bill is about changing some laws that have been held over from a different era when we thought that throwing those fish guts was a bad idea. We have a large number of people supporting groups like Steelheaders, CCA, Trout Unlimited, and others supporting it. And we also appreciate the supportive advice of ODFNW. In fact, they've helped us simplify the bill dramatically from how it was introduced because we didn't need to go into all the explanations of where you would put the carcasses. Right now, science is pretty clear that the nutrients are very helpful to be put back in the river. And that these nutrients help with all the other things. Excuse me, I'm getting all tongue twisted. I was trying to do this quickly. Help with nutrients in the water, and as a result, smolts eat a lot of what's there and also grow faster. And we're finding that they're part of the system, and they even help the vegetation grow. So I want to thank ODFNW for helping us with this bill. I should also point out that a lot of our steelhead and salmon fishermen currently return fish guts. It's a little illegal at the moment, so this will help make them legal. And finally, I want to give you a quote from one of my fishers. A lady from Oregon City, she says, I support the idea of releasing fish carcasses back into the river. It gives vital nutrients to the rivers and reduces the smell around the cleaning stations. Win-win situation. I think she kind of summarized it. Okay. And incidentally, we'll have testimony from some experts who will talk about more about the nutrients and the importance of returning the carcasses. And delighted to have Representative Hoyle here as well as a co-sponsor.
Great. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Val Hoyle, represent West Eugene and Junction City. I want to thank you for allowing us to testify today. This is a bill that passed the House 60-0. My mother's family were all fishermen. They were commercial fishermen off the coast of Ireland. And when my grandfather came here, he instilled an appreciation for not only for commercial fishing, but for what we were able to get from the rivers, from the oceans. And this bill is just good policy. We know that fish carcasses are important to our ecosystem, and we currently have countless volunteers receiving permits from DEQ and spending their time putting salmon carcasses from hatcheries into the local watersheds. Our neighboring states, Idaho, Washington, and Alaska, allow this policy. It's time we join them as well. It's an easy fix. It's the right thing to do. It's the best thing for the ecosystem. So I hope that you'll support this bill and let it go to the floor of the Senate, and that you will also have a unanimous vote so the governor can sign the bill.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, Bob Olson, Northwest Steelheaders. I am here to introduce the bill, but with that great introduction, I don't have to say a whole lot. I think they covered the background and the history of that. You have the statement in front of you from Northwest Steelheaders, which gives you a little bit more information about the time that it's been on working on the bill and the importance of it. Having regular anglers place their fish carcasses back in streams and rivers will achieve important nutrient enhancement, and it will provide additional food source for fish and animals and certainly the vegetation. So it's really a good bill, and I think it's been shaped in a good form through the House process, and we hope you support it.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hansel?
Can we ask questions?
Absolutely.
Okay. Would it be safe for me to assume that you don't want us to gut this bill?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, in a bipartisan way, we would make a request that you didn't gut and stuff this bill, although gutting and stuffing fish is a good thing. Gutting and stuffing this bill would be not a good thing.
I understand.
Excuse me, but Senator, I'm hoping that you do have the guts to support the bill. Yes, please.
All right, one more pun, and the bill is dead. All right, any other questions?
I do have a question. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Kennemer, it says that the person retain proof of compliance. How would they do that?
Just the fillet itself would not really tell you that it's...
Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let Fish and Wildlife help
okay.
you with that, because I will explain it partially correctly, and that's
okay.
not helpful. And, and they will also give you some of the other scientific data, so you'll understand, and we appreciate ODF&W working with us to make this a simpler process. We thought that we needed to identify these animals or these fish in a different way and do several and specify where people returned them in the water and all kinds of things that made it really unworkable. And I appreciate the simplification, but they can explain how they'll look at it.
Thank you.
And we're going to call them up next. So any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Bringing this forward, and we'll look forward to cooking this one. Okay. So, why don't we have the Department of Fish and Wildlife come up? And we also have Joe Ruhlader and from the Oregon Salmon Commission and Tom Wolf. So, gentlemen, you can all come up. Being efficient. There you go. But let's have ODF&W go first and tell us about how you're going to implement this bill.
Sure.
Maybe you can touch on the history a little
sure.
bit.
Sure. I will do all of the above. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I am providing some brief written comments to you as well. I'll paraphrase those here, and then happy to answer any questions. So, as was described, House Bill 2697 would allow anglers to discard the carcass of legally caught fish into the water from which the fish was caught. We have a long history now at ODFW of work in this same arena. Since the mid-1990s, we've had a program or various programs in place where we have placed hatchery carcasses, that is surplus hatchery fish carcasses, in streams as a nutrient enrichment for nutrient enrichment purposes. Early on, back if you'll recall in the 1990s, there was confusion and controversy regarding whether or not we needed a DEQ permit to do those activities. We have ironed all those details out, and I believe since 2007, we have not needed a specific permit for each of those actions. And in fact, just for an example, and this is mentioned in the written testimony as well, during the the year 2011-2012, we and our volunteers, and I don't want to overlook or understate the importance of the volunteers in this program, but we placed over 36,000 surplus hatchery Chinook salmon, coho salmon, or steelhead carcasses in a variety of streams, I think about 100 different streams statewide. That totaled 411,000 pounds of fish carcasses, if you will. And we know from recent literature as well as just experiential knowledge that these nutrients and these marine-derived nutrients are an important component of the ecosystem and the food web. During our annual or biennial or sometimes every four-year angling regulation review process, we continually hear from our constituents with one question, and that is, why can't I legally place my own carcass or the entrails back in the stream as the state's doing it under our own nutrient enrichment program? And unfortunately, based on language in Oregon Revised Statute 164.785, we have not had the flexibility to allow them to do that. These carcasses were, under that statute, considered offensive littering, I believe was the term, but nonetheless, we could not, in the angling regulation process, allow them legally to do that. So House Bill 2697 makes it clear that this activity is legal and permitted, and we think is an important component can be adequately implemented. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson had a question about the angler must retain compliance with any angling regulation or something to that effect. That language is in the statute. And what that's referring to is in many cases we have either size regulations in place or hatchery fin clip requirements in place, or in some cases species identification is a critical factor. And so anglers are responsible to know what the regulations are and know that while they're in the field, until they've returned to their vehicle, that they can prove to an enforcement officer that they have complied with any regulation that's in place. In fact, if they have not complied, that's a different violation in terms of their retaining the proof of compliance. So in most cases, that would be the proof that the fish was fin clipped, but in some cases, it could be the size of the fish as well.
Did that answer your question?
No, I'd like to ask a question of Kurt, if I could. The question then being is, say someone's out angling and they catch a fish and they bring it up to their camp and they clean it. And after they clean it and taken the carcass down and thrown it in, a trooper comes by and says, you know, what do you have there? And they wouldn't have that proof. So how are you going to get over that hurdle? That's my only concern is that there's going to be a bump up in the law here someplace.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, in fact, the angling regulations are written such that after a person returns to their place of residence, and that can be a temporary residence, including a campsite, a RV, they once they've returned to that particular spot, then they are free to process the fish. They don't have to retain proof of compliance.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
And I have another quick question, Kurt. Are you, and maybe I missed this in your testimony, but do you need to do rulemaking, or is that just in case you have to clarify?
Chair Dingfelder, we would, certainly right now in our angling regulations, we do refer to this activity as being illegal because we don't want to have people out of compliance with state law. So our rulemaking, if you will, associated with this will be simply updating our angling regulation booklet to reflect what the current status is. Over time, if there were certain areas that became a problem, and this is, I think, as Representative Kinnemer reflected upon, we worked with him to really simplify the language in this bill. Over time, if there was a particular area where offensive littering became a problem, where they were complying with all the provisions of the law, but it was still offensive, i.e., perhaps at a boat ramp or something like that, we could adopt rules to address localized issues, but right now, immediately, there would not be any sizable rulemaking associated with this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I have another one for Kurt. Just out of curiosity, you're out on your houseboat on the Willamette River and you catch a nice salmon. Fish and chips out of bounds here, or do you consider the houseboat or their sled to be still angling? I don't want guys getting in trouble over this. It's a great idea to do this. It's necessary. But I just don't want guys getting in trouble if they fillet the fish and have lunch on their boat.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, I think if an individual was returning to a floating home, clearly that would qualify as returning to a residence. If they were on their individual vessel, whether that be a sled or other floating vessel, and they filleted the fish and ate half of it, for instance, they would need to retain the carcass until they returned to the boat ramp to prove that they were, in fact, adhering to all the other regulations associated with the activity.
Thank you. That's clears up for me.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Gentlemen, whoever wants to go next.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2697. We believe this is a good bill. I was on the Deschutes this weekend fishing, and really sad that Senator Bates isn't here, but so I feel that statement is wasted. But anyway, in eastern Oregon, they're very fortunate. The streams there are alkaline, and they have a lot of nutrients on their own, and therefore you see a lot of macroinvertebrates and stuff that you don't see on west side streams, and that's because west side streams and coastal streams are very sterile, and they depend a lot on the nutrients that are brought into them by fish carcasses. In the past, when there were huge runs and the carcasses the salmon would die and provide carcasses in the stream, there'd be a lot of nutrients. And over the years, for a lot of different reasons, whether we removed the carcass or there were less fish, there have been a lot less nutrients put on. And ODFW and the Forest Service and other agencies have been trying to remedy that lately by going out and putting fish carcasses in the streams. And a lot of our Trout Unlimited volunteers have been involved with that. And that's a great thing. This bill would just allow individual anglers to put the carcasses in to continue that nutrient enriching part of the stream. So we think this is a good bill. It's a simple bill, and we urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Joe?
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm here today representing the Oregon Salmon Commission. I don't have any puns, but we do support this bill very much. As long as we're all telling fish stories, though, I'll tell you about when I was a little boy. I grew up at in a town called Nimrod on the Mackenzie River, and it was pre-dam, flood control dams, which was a day or two ago, and I did earn all this gray hair. So many spring Chinook spawned in front of our house that in the evening when the wind would quit blowing down the river, your eyes would water from pneumonia. And when I was a little kid, of course, I was kind of short, and I used to wade in front of the house, and these big salmon carcasses would come down the river, and they really stunk. And unfortunately, those salmon carcasses are not there anymore. And those were nutrients that were very necessary. So thank you very much, and I hope you support this bill.
Okay, any questions for this panel?
Joe, it sounded like Joe didn't have any skin in the game, and I'd just like you to get a little backbone over this.
No. Thank you. That's a great pun. I'll write that down.
Well, we went through everything else.
I think we got them all.
I don't know what else we can do.
Senator Hess, any last parting words? All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? No more puns. Okay, great. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2697A. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2249A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2249A establishes the Willamette River Basin Bonneville Power Administration Stewardship Fund. It stipulates that the fund shall consist of monies accepted by the state pursuant to the Willamette Basin Memorandum of Agreement regarding wildlife habitat protection and enhancement between ODFW and BPA dated October 22, 2010, and it requires money in the fund to be appropriated to ODFW for long-term operation, maintenance, and protection activities that preserve or advance conservation values of properties purchased under the MOA.
Great, thank you. Let's see. So we have, Kurt Melcher back up. And also Chris. Okay, welcome back, Kurt.
Thank you. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to be back here again this afternoon. I do have with me Mr. Chris Wheaton. He's our Northwest Region Manager, and in his role with the department, he has oversight of the Willamette Wildlife Mitigation Program. So I have him here today in case there are specific questions. We're providing written comments, some written comments to you. I'll go through and highlight those real quickly. For members of the committee. So House Bill 2249, from our perspective, is really an accounting bill. It creates a dedicated account for some funds associated with wildlife mitigation from the Bonneville Power Administration, and it gives flexibility to us and the state treasurer to be able to invest those funds in the intermediate term pool, which certainly has a higher yield than the standard short-term investments that we're currently restricted to. So, by way of background, in 2010, Governor Kulongoski signed the Memorandum of Agreement with Bonneville Power Administration to settle the long-term wildlife mitigation obligation associated with development of the Willamette Basin hydro and flood control system. The Northwest Power Act, I believe, of 1980 required that Bonneville provide that mitigation, and over the last better part of three decades, the mitigation work was going on really on an ad hoc basis without any real oversight or direction, certainly not from the state, and also without any true understanding from Bonneville in terms of what their long-term obligation was. So for us and for the state of Oregon to finally close the chapter and have this mitigation, long-term mitigation agreement in place was an important step. Equally important with regard to the long-term mitigation benefits that Bonneville is going to provide in terms of wildlife habitat, they've also agreed to fund the Department of Fish and Wildlife over the next 15 years to pay for stewardship, management, and restoration activities at the properties that they acquire or on the conservation easements that they acquire. So for us, that's a really big step. Again, as I mentioned, over the last several decades, these properties were coming online either in form of conservation easements or outright acquisitions, with no one having responsibility to keep track and not only monitor the projects but also provide restoration and good stewardship as it relates to invasive species and other issues. So, with that, over the next 15 years, we expect to receive $26 million from Bonneville to conduct long-term stewardship and maintenance of these properties. And we are asking through House Bill 2249 that we have a dedicated account in which to put those funds, as well as the investment flexibility to provide long-term benefits and hopefully sustainability over time. As I mentioned, I have Mr. Wheaton here, and I did also want to highlight the fact there was some confusion that this fund was associated with property acquisitions, that it would be used to acquire property or acquire conservation easements. That is not the case. This fund is really allows us to manage and monitor and improve the properties that Bonneville does purchase under the program. So we did have an amendment on the House side just to clarify that this fund is not used for property acquisitions or conservation easement acquisitions. With that, Chair Dinkfelder, I'd be happy to answer any questions or turn the mic over to Mr. Wheaton if you have any questions for him.
Mr. Wheaton, do you want to add anything to that before we go to questions, or are you just here in case there's any questions? Okay, any questions for the department? I actually have one.
Very good.
What is the other money being used for? I mean, you talk about the $117 million over 15-year period, so is that not going to the state? Is that the BPA is using that directly, or where is that money being?
Yeah.
Is that being utilized as part of the Willamette SIP, you know, through OWIB or?
Yeah. Chair Dinkfelder, I'm going to actually let Mr. Wheaton answer that. I do know the answer as well, but since he traveled all the way down here,
yes,
I really want to make him,
I
want to have him have the opportunity to get on the record as well.
If you can explain to us, that would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kurt. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, the $117 million is actually
to acquire properties.
Can you please state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Chris Wheaton, Northwest Regional Manager for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The $117 million is the fund that is used to acquire properties. That's done through an easement or a direct purchase process by BPA. The actual holders of most of these properties are local conservation groups, land trusts, and so on, local governments. In a few cases, ODFW will take ownership, but it's not primarily an acquisition program for us. It's basically to get these properties protected in perpetuity for conservation purposes to mitigate for the loss of wildlife habitat from the Willamette Dams.
And so we have allocated $26 million out of that for maintenance and assistance. For the department over the 15
yeah,
years.
Yeah, Chair Dingfeld, I believe it's in addition to that.
Is it in addition?
It's in addition to that, yes.
Okay. And are those properties that have already been acquired, or this is over the same period, 15-year period?
Chair Dingfeld, or members of the committee, the totality of the funds is to purchase a total of 26,000 plus or minus acres, which would be enough to fulfill the mitigation requirement as negotiated between the state and BPA. So we've got roughly 10,000 already purchased through the last 10 years or so of projects. We've got a target of about 16,000 additional acres to purchase or protect through easement over the next 15 years. And so we're working in consolidation and cooperation with a number of partners and BPA to identify those and spend that $117 million on acquisition.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's helpful. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I think we have a couple more people that would like to testify
Thanks.
On this. Sue Marshall and Tom Wolf. I'm going to hand this over to you.
Okay. Welcome. Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Willamette Riverkeeper in support of House Bill 2249. I'd just like to give you a little bit of a background on the Willamette River Basin project and the impact it's had on the Willamette River Basin. In 1941, Army Corps of Engineers built their first dam in the Willamette Basin, and they proceeded over the next 20 years to build 12 more. They additionally installed 93 miles of revetment, which reinforced and channelized the riverbank. There were benefits to many with the 1.6 million acre-feet of water that were provided by all of these dams and this storage, flood control, mitigation, municipal water, recreation, and power generation. It was thought at the time that hatcheries would be adequate to mitigate for all of these impacts. Formerly, there were huge runs of anadromous fish in the Willamette River system. The biological opinion of NOAA Fisheries just a few years ago concluded that there's an ongoing impact from these dams that jeopardize the continued existence of Upper Willamette, Chinook, and Steelhead. And the memorandum of agreement with BPA is infusing this $117 million over the next 15 years. And the thinking of NOAA Fisheries is that this will help to have an immediate impact to improve the viability of the fish populations and reduce the short-term risk of extinction. ODFW's piece of the pie is $26 million, which is the subject of the bill before you, and it will go to the long-term maintenance, operation, and protection of the lands that are purchased under the broader agreement. We think that establish this fund will allow the Treasury to make investments, reap a bit of interest with these funds, and we think it's a good idea and encourage your support of the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I was hoping Senator Bates would be here for this because I was going to work the Deschutes story in, but again, but since he's not, I'll move on. ODFW.
I have a few more weeks to try to work
yeah,
the
I know,
story.
Yeah, I know. Don't worry about it. There's really some other stuff coming up. But anyway, ODFW convened a group of stakeholders a few years ago to to set up the parameters for how to purchase the properties in Willamette Valley, and I was had the honor of sitting on that for several meetings. And the Willamette Valley is a very unique ecosystem that, unfortunately, because a lot of people live here, has been we've lost a lot of pieces of it that are not able to protect. And this funding will be able to protect areas and provide easements to for conservation values of a very unique ecosystem. So, and the $26 million that ODFW is going to be acquiring will be used for monitoring and restoration and protecting. And let me tell you, in the Tour Island Limited is involved in a lot of restoration efforts across the state, and a lot of, and sometimes in acquisition, and monitoring and restoration is always the part that's hardest to require funding for. So this $26 million will be a great asset in dealing with these projects that we acquire, the easements that we that are acquired with the larger pot of money, and will be of a great benefit in restoration and monitoring. So we urge you to support this bill. We think it's a good bill, and we'll be used to protect a very fragile ecosystem in the Willamette Valley. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for either of these panelists?
Great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to come up and testify on House Bill 20? Let's see. Make sure we're in the right one. 2249A. All righty. With that, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2249A, and Senator Hansel and I need to sneak out to a meeting, and so we're going to hand the gavel over and to my trusty vice chair to talk about crabs.
You handed it over to the crab, didn't you?
We will open the public hearing on House Bill 3262A. And Beth, if you would talk about that, please.
Yes, Chair Olson. House Bill 3262A prohibits a person from leaving a crab pot or prohibits person leaving crab pot used in ocean Dungeness crab fishery in waters of the state for more than 15 days after season closure. It authorizes the commission to issue permits for removal of crab pots left in violation of removal requirement, regardless of whether the person removing the crab pot originally set the pot, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
And we have two that would like to testify. That would be Joe. Would you like to come back up? And Kurt, please.
Nick Furman.
Oh, and Nick Furman, please.
Sorry.
Furman, I'm sorry. It was yellow dot.
I know. Sorry.
Mr. Furman, we've heard from everybody else first. We'll let you go first.
Oh, fine. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nick Furman. For 22 years, I was the executive director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, an industry-funded commodity commission under the umbrella of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I've been asked by the commission to come here today and ask for your support for HB 3262A, which addresses Oregon's derelict crab gear problem. Fishermen on the Oregon coast deploy upwards of 120,000 crab pots annually from the Columbia River to the California border, and the reality is that not all those crab pots come back in at the end of the year. We have tried a number of different programs and projects in partnership with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and independently, volunteer gear recovery weeks, end of the season crab pot roundups, bounty programs, but none of them have been truly effective and none of them have been sustainable. We think that the legislation proposed in HB 3262A will enable the industry to work in partnership with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to put together a meaningful industry-driven cleanup program with minimal costs and what we feel will be big dividends, industry solving an industry problem. It's quite that simple. We would develop a program similar to what has been working successfully in Washington State for the last 4 years, allowing fishermen to go out at the end of the season, providing they're signed up with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, bring in derelict crab pots, and dispose of them as they see fit. This bill will simply provide the platform that will allow the industry to work with the Fish and Wildlife Commission to accomplish what we think will be a very successful program, and we hope that we can count on your support.
Thank you. Mr. Melcher.
Sure.
Want to go, Joe?
No.
All right.
Thank you.
Get a backbone again.
Absolutely. Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we've provided written comments as well, brief written comments. Just echoing Mr. Furman's statements, certainly House Bill 3262A is designed to resolve the conflict between Oregon's personal property laws and our collective interest. That would be the interest not only of the fishing industry, but also the department, and we believe Oregonians at large, to address this issue of lost crab gear that's lost at sea. And I think Nick alluded to it as well, but each year we estimate that approximately 10,000 pots are lost at sea. That's about 7.5% of the pots that are deployed annually. As you know, the crab fishery occurs during the winter months, and weather is a huge factor in those losses as it relates to just storm events and shifting sands and other complications. So some of these pots are recovered by the owner during the season, but many of them remain lost over the course of many months or even years. They then provide conflict or do have conflict with other fisheries, salmon, troll, and trawl fisheries, as well as continuing to have an impact on the resource. At least some of the pots for a period of time will continue to fish, essentially ghost fish. So we all have an interest in cleaning those pots up, and we've made great strides in recent years with both the federal program as well as state programs to address that, and we believe this bill is really the last step to giving the industry the tools that they need to help address the problem. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Let's go. Joe, would you mind, please?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I represent Seafood Oregon, which is the four ocean commodity commissions, and the Dungeness Crab Commission is one of those four commissions. Getting a backbone here, I will tell you that when I have experts available, I don't need to say anything. We support this bill, and we hope you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. The disincentive that you speak about now is that this is, nobody wants to pick these up because they may belong to someone else, and you'd have to deal with that if you do, yeah. And it might be considered stealing, or is that the disincentive?
Certainly, Vice Chair Olson and Senator Haas, that is precisely the disincentive. And, in fact, it's bigger than just a disincentive. If they are at sea now and they find lost gear out of season, they have to abide by the personal property laws, which say, yeah, they can pick them up, but then they have to go through pretty great efforts in order to comply to find the legitimate owner of the pot. And this bill would essentially allow them, it would provide the incentive that if they're out of season, so during closed season, finding and removing crab gear, they are not obligated to find the owner. That gear then either becomes their property to do with whatever they may choose, whether that be to refurbish and use in their own operation or to resell, or in some cases, and I think in many cases, and Nick, I'd certainly be happy to have Nick talk about this too. In many cases, I think the pots are really scrap because they're not salvageable for future fishing.
If I may, Vice Chair Olson and Senator Haas, in addition to providing an incentive to somebody that wants to spend the time in the fall to go out and harvest derelict crab pots, it also, this bill is will provide the potential for the incentive for fishermen who aren't inclined to take the effort to go out and get that gear to round it up if they know that if they don't, it will soon become somebody else's property. And with a crab pot, a new crab pot in good condition, approaching $250 to $300, it becomes a sizable investment. And so we think that there'll be incentive both to harvest them and incentive to bring it in and clean up the ocean, should this bill pass and a program be developed.
Senator, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, is 15 days enough if you've got, why was 15 days? Why not a month? Is that enough?
Sure.
If I got a new crab pot and I just didn't get it up in time, or I didn't see it, or that I lost it.
Sure. Vice Chair Olson, Senator Hass, at least from the department's perspective, we certainly think that's enough time, and I would defer to the industry folks to talk about it any more specifically than that, but we certainly think that's enough time. Remember that the closure, so the season opens typically, historically, December 1st, it's open all through the winter, but then the closure doesn't occur until August. So the closure and that two-week window when the season is finally closed in most cases is during a period of exceptionally good weather. It's very unlikely that you have 2 weeks when individuals cannot get to see to remove their gear.
Vice Chair Wilson, Senator Hass. Presently, right now, the regulations require that fishermen have the gear in the dock by 15 days after the closure. And during that 15-day period, which allows small boats to go out and get them and take advantage of good weather and bring in multiple trips, the lids have to be opened, and those pots are not allowed to be baited, so they can't be fishing. Those crabs have to be returned. But after that 15-day period, then any gear that is left in the ocean is technically illegal gear. And the incentive through this bill and the program that we envision being established will provide opportunity for fishermen to go out and harvest those pots if for one reason or another they're left in the ocean and bring them in, where otherwise they wouldn't be inclined to do that because of the expense involved in doing that.
Thank you. Last question.
Thank you.
Logistically, how do they know they're there, and how do you bring
them? How do you do it? That's my question.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and let Nick answer it. I have some thoughts on it, too, but Nick,
okay.
Go ahead. You've
Vice
had
Chair
a lot of experience.
Olson and Senator Hass. Each pot that's deployed in the ocean is marked by an individual buoy. And so a lot of the derelict gear that's in the ocean is still visible, although the buoys by the end of the season are all mossed up and full of green and algae, but they're still floating and they're still visible. Part of the problem that we've encountered over the years with derelict gear is that a lot of time when the season's approaching the end or when fishermen have to move into other fisheries, the current has those buoys submerged, and so they can't actually go find that gear. They go off into other fisheries, those pots get forgotten about, and then later on at the end of the season, when the current slacks off, those buoys pop back up, and then they're visible. And so that window period from September 1st through, say, mid-October is a perfect time of the year to basically clean up the ocean.
Senator Bates, do you have any more, Senator Hass?
Well, what about when the buoy is off, if it comes off and they just go to the bottom, that's it, nobody's going to recover those, right?
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Hass, in most cases that's true. They would not be recovered. There has been work done with sonar, high-tech sonar, in locating gear that does not have a buoy on the surface, and I think it's been done with some success. But generally speaking, if the buoys are cut and the line is on the bottom, the pot's going to get sanded in, and you're not going to find it.
Vice Chair Olson and Senator Hass, if I could just add to that, there are areas of concentration on the coast, particularly off the Columbia River, because of the amount of ship traffic, where cutoff crab pots are an extreme problem. Sometimes upwards of 10% of the crab pots are deployed in that area. And they have been quite successful, actually, over the last couple of decades in grappling for that gear. And so we think that this bill will encourage people that want to take the effort to tow grapples behind their vessels to pull up that gear. So it will address both the visual pots that have got buoys floating on the surface, but also we think that the lion's share, especially in areas where there are large concentrations of gear that's been cut off, will be rounded up in this process.
Thank you.
Dr. Bates?
Yeah, I think most of my questions were answered. I thought I came in a few minutes late, so I was on the LFO. I thought I heard something like 10,000 pots are lost. Was I hear that right? And what will this bill? I mean, if you're losing 10,000 pots, is that a year?
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Bates, that is our estimate. Yeah, about 7.5% of the gear that's deployed gets lost. Some of it gets subsequently recovered in later years, but at least if you take that snapshot of the crab season, it's about 10,000.
And
Paul,
Phillips,
sir.
And if you, with this bill, what do you think would happen as far as that 10,000? How much can you reduce that number that you get those pulled back in? Any idea? You have to find out and see. Sort of wait and see thing.
Yeah, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Bates, we don't have, at least from the department's perspective, we don't have a specific estimate, but we do have individuals telling us that if they had the incentive to go out and retrieve lost gear and had the benefit of then being able to keep it themselves as opposed to having to go and find the rightful owner, they would do that.
Yes.
And Nick may have, I know Washington's been doing this for several years.
Vice Chair Olson and Senator Bates. I think that, first of all, with all due respect, I think that the 10 to 12,000 or 10%, 7 to 10% is actually a pretty high figure because although gear might get lost as strings are dispersed and so forth, quite a bit of that gear ultimately gets found and gets brought back in outside of a program just in traditional ways. But I think the 10% was originally, the figure was originally derived from the extreme amount of cutoff that occurs on the Columbia River because of the ship traffic. And that 10% figure kind of stuck there. But also, fishermen have a tendency, there's a provision in the crab pot bill that allows fishermen to get new tags if they declare that they've lost gear up to 10%. So miraculously, everybody loses 10% at the start of the season so that they can get more tags because we have a limit, because they're only allowed a limited amount of pots. So unfortunately, I think that 10% figure, it gets out there in the world, so to speak. Washington's program last year with a much smaller amount of gear loss and a smaller fleet, about half the permits that Oregon had, they rounded up 1,900 pots in that period of time. So we think that with the incentive of people being able to dispose of those pots how they choose to, either sell them back to the owner, keep them themselves, or put them on the open market, we think that the incentive will be there to clear up quite a bit of the gear.
I have two questions. One, what is the life span of a pot in the ocean on its own? I mean, how long will it take before it breaks down? Do you know that?
Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, so one thing we did not talk about here today is we do have regulations regarding the escape rings and the pot has escape panels that are secured with a twine that's biodegradable. So over the course of, and I can't remember the timeline, but the twine does biodegrade and the pot, at least in theory, becomes at least a non-fishing pot. But as far as how long it takes a steel, rubber-wrapped, and stainless steel wire pot to disintegrate at the seafloor, I don't know. It's certainly a lengthy amount of time, I would imagine, and maybe Nick has a better answer.
Vice Chair Olson, crab pots are made out of steel rebar, rubber-wrapped, and fishermen actually have to put zincs on them because of the electrolysis in the ocean. Without those zincs, the pot will eat up right away. So the steel itself in the pot will probably disintegrate quicker than the stainless steel mesh around the outside. But I think quite candidly, and Kurt was correct in that because of very good regulations regarding how that pot is made so that the lids have to open, we're not ghost fishing with those pots. And quite frankly, those pots probably sand in and are buried under the surface in a fairly quick time. It's a fairly dynamic environment out there, especially where crab fishermen fish in close to the beach. And that those pots have a tendency, even in the course of a month or so, to get buried 6, 7, 8, 9 feet deep. So
the reason I ask that question, the visual of 10,000 pots and over how many years, just seems like the place is just littered with pots. But is there any other questions on this?
Just a quick statement, because I can't control myself. This bill is designed to keep the ocean from going to pot. All right.
I was waiting for that one.
You know that would be coming, right?
Is there any good fishing at the Deschutes? There's a Deschutes River fishing story waiting for you.
Okay. No, there's no bass involved, right?
No. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3262A? If not, I will close the public hearing on 3262A. Is there any other order of business for the good of the committee? If not, we will close this committee meeting.